Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It has just ticked over to the 17th of December 2013 here across the dateline in Japan. Today, we're joined from the United States by John Young of Cryptome.org, a previous guest on the Corbett Report. So I'll invite people to check into my interview archives for our previous conversation. And for those who don't know, Cryptome.org has been described as the original WikiLeaks. Certainly, it has been online since June 1996, but I think our guest would probably bristle at that description. John, how do you describe Cryptome.org and what it does?
We call it a free public library and make documents available for people to use in their own way. We do almost no editorial commentary or hyperventilating about what we've got. So in that sense, we're quite different from WikiLeaks and the other high-profile sites.
Absolutely. And that was very much the center of our discussion, I believe, back in 2009, How Time Flies. So it's been a long time. But again, people can check into the archives where we talked more about Cryptome and the work that you do there. But today I want to talk about, obviously, what's happening right now in the world of cipher hacking and all of these types of issues that are swirling around the recent release of information and documents from Edward Snowden, talking about the NSA and its various spying programs and the reporting on that by Glenn Greenwald and others. A very interesting set of topics, but one that I think we have to start by probably establishing a base of information about what's actually happened and what we can establish. And I suppose the first question to really establish is, how many documents did Edward Snowden have, and how do we know that information? Do we have a set number on this, and where are we getting our sources on that type of information from?
The number has varied considerably from an original claim of about 10,000, now up to 1.1 million, depending on who is giving out the number. The journalist outlets use the number roughly of about 58,000. NSA and some congressional leaders talk about millions of documents. And so there's something of a war going on about how much he actually took. And so we don't know who's understating and overstating, but clearly there's a large gap between the claims. What we've done is we've actually tracked what's been released, and right now it's just under 800 pages, not documents, pages that have been released by the media. And that is far less than 1% of what they claim they've got. And so there's even a gap between what the media claim they've got and what has actually been released. And so we think there's credibility gap on all sides at the moment.
Well, there certainly seems to be a lack of concrete information to go on. And again, it's a question of which source are we going to trust to even come up with a number of how many documents were taken from the NSA, if indeed that's even exactly what occurred. But along a similar track, so we know that about 800 pages of documents have been published so far, again, less than 1% of what they claim. But do we have any indication of what type of deal that Snowden had with the people who are reporting on this? Do we have any idea of what Snowden's intentions were with this information or how it would be distributed?
Well, we actually only have the word of the outlets. Principally Greenwald, who's lead spokesperson for this, who claims that Snowden said, handle it any way you like, with one caveat, which is limit harm to the United States. But the format, the release, what will be released was left up to the outlets. And that seems to be slightly consistent with all the outlets, of which we now found about 12 outlets have published actual pages rather than editorial commentary, which there are thousands of articles now, editorial without publishing any documents. So there's far more narrative, if you will, hyperventilating about the documents than actually showing the documents to the public.
There certainly has been a lot of hype about this recently, and of course you bring up Greenwald, who has been the lead reporter, but have other journalists actually acquired these documents? Is Greenwald the only one with access to this? How is this actually working at this point? Did Snowden actually give over all of these documents?
What has been reported is that the original recipients of documents was Greenwald and Laura Poitras and a Guardian reporter, whose name escapes me at the moment. They all met with Snowden in Hong Kong. The other parallel release was to Barton Gellman at the Washington Post, and which apparently occurred about the same time. And so those are the original font of these documents. And they have each taken a different approach to this.
And I've heard it reported that Snowden claims that he has destroyed all of his documents now so that he doesn't have any of this information anymore. Is that right?
I've read that. Thing is, we have very little direct reporting by Snowden himself. Nearly everything is paraphrased or run through other outlets, and one of the things we've been watching for is trying to find out what Snowden himself is saying compared to what his spokespeople or alleged representatives are saying. And there's considerable difference of style and language in the two. And so that his most recent things seem very much like public relations releases, artfully crafted by lawyers and others, which would make sense to not make mistakes. And so we don't actually know what he did, except by these intermediaries. If he's well trained in communication security, he did not limit the distribution to just these outlets. He would have done some insurance coverage, if you will, by stashing them somewhere else in case these outlets were betrayed or spied on or co-opted in some way, which he's trained in knowing how to do that. And you don't give away all those secrets, but you do plant protection for yourself. And so even Greenwald has said that some copies of this material has been given to others for safekeeping. But we don't know where or how. And so we don't know how much of this is rhetoric or not. As you know, all spies use tremendous amounts of rhetoric. And so this confusion is a standard operating procedure.
Well, that's right. And I have been following this story since its inception, but even I find it difficult to measure all the claims and counterclaims and where the claims are coming from. So I think that certainly some of this has to be intentional in order to create some of the confusion about what really is out there and where it's coming from and how it's coming, etc. But you did mention, for example, that there's a difference in reporting between some of these intermediaries who have gotten their hands on these documents. Obviously, two of the main camps being Greenwald and The Guardian, who he's also working with media outlets around the world to publish these stories in various local media outlets. But then we have Barton Gellman over at the Washington Post. When you refer to the difference in style in these reportings, what are you talking about?
Well, Barton Gellman is a longtime national security reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner. He's a professional reporter. Greenwald is a polemicist and lawyer. And so Barton has been much more focusing on the story rather than the effect of the story. So the difference of style. And, of course, the Washington Post is a long-time outlet for briefings by security agencies, and, of course, it's a hometown industry for the Washington Post. And The Guardian is more of a British arm-weaving outlet, which is fine. It's great entertaining. So there's difference in style there. I think The Guardian seeks more publicity than Washington Post does. And that's true of most of the other outlets. And I should say is that The Guardian and the WAPO, that's a short word for Washington Post, have published by far the greatest amount of pages, over 200 in each case. The other outlets have published very small numbers, half a dozen, a dozen, and usually fragments of documents. And so that's a big gap between those two original outlets and the current crop that are publishing only small amounts in different countries. That may be due to the fact that different countries have different arrangement between the spies and the media there. There are different laws. And so I think the other countries are being far more cautious than The Guardian and The Washington Post.
Now, the claim was recently made, I believe, by a representative of The Guardian, and I believe talking to a parliamentary committee in the UK, although I don't have these specifics off the top of my head, that I believe The Guardian itself has consulted GCHQ and presumably the US government on hundreds of occasions with regards to these documents so far. Again, do we have any idea of the sort of cooperation that's gone on between these media outlets and the governments that they're reporting on with these document releases?
It is conventional that outlets covering national security consult with governments. Otherwise, they won't get any information fed to them and likely will come under suspicion, if not prosecution, if they don't check. And so it's a long-standing tradition that national security coverage is done in consultation with governments. Nothing unusual about that. there is the degree of the question of how much consultation, how much control. The Times, New York Times, for example, admits to consulting. Sometimes they claim they resist. Sometimes they just say they consulted. But I'll just say again, is that all intelligence agencies work closely with their domestic media and briefing them and costing them and coaching them on how to cover it just because that's part of their job.
Yes, I suppose nothing particularly surprising in that respect. Well, let's turn to some of the more problematic aspects of this this entire way in which this information is being released, and let's focus on a series of articles that Sibel Edmonds has been publishing at BoilingFrogsPost.com, talking about the recent formation of the NewCo venture funded by billionaire Pierre Omidyar, and now starring star reporter Glenn Greenwald and some of his friends, including Jeremy Scahill and other reporters who will presumably be part of this new operation. And this has raised a number of troubling questions about Greenwald and his intentions on reporting on this story, the speed with which these documents are being released, and whether some are being withheld in order to basically up the value of this information. A lot of very interesting questions that Sibel has been raising in this series of articles, and receiving a lot of flack from supporters of Greenwald who seem to believe that there could be no possibility of suspicion of any wrongdoing on his part in all of this. I'd be very interested to hear your take on basically these ideas, these allegations, and this formation of this new co-venture with eBay co-founder Pierre Omidyar.
Well, I have to recall that we publish documents, and that's our interest here, and that's why we're tracking what's actually been released compared to what's been written about what's been released. And so there's a huge gap between what the outlets claim to have and what they're releasing. Without apology, they claim that, well, actually, there are various claims about why they claim they're doing that. One is to keep the story going for as long as possible and not, quote, what they call dumping everything all at once, which is the model we prefer. And so that one of the issues that we're most concerned about here is why is this material not being more generously shared with the public? And so that does raise the issue of, well, is it being done for commercial reasons, that it's going to be stretched out as long as possible, which is a journalistic practice, nothing wrong with that. These are commercial outlets. And so there, up until recently, there has not been a major way for material to get to the public except through commercial outlets. And so they hoarded it, guarded it, released it very carefully. The New York Times, everyone does that. And so the Internet has provided at least some outlets for this stuff to come out in a more unrestricted way. The WikiLeaks does it. We do it on a much smaller scale. But we've counted about 100 other sites on the Internet that release information in documentary form, not by journalism. And so I think that if it goes through journalism, it's going to be commercialized or, as they say, monetized. I'd also note that billionaires have gotten very active in journalism. Carlos Slim at the New York Times, Murdoch at the Wall Street Journal, and now Bezos with Washington Post. So there seems to be a trend going on here. It's not as though they haven't had influence before, but they're now coming out front to run journalistic outlets. So we haven't had much experience until recently to see what the consequence of this will be. Journalists are delighted, and they love to have financial support for what they're doing and not be wholly dependent upon advertising. So that could be a positive step. And so I'm being agnostic about this at the moment. As an architect, I've worked with billionaires. They do not always tell you what they're up to. And so that right now there's a PR war going on about this, and we'll see how it sorts itself out.
Well, we will have to, I think, see how this does sort itself out. But certainly there's the question of the conflict of interest of someone specifically with Pierre Omidyar's background and his connection to PayPal, which presumably even Glenn Greenwald admits he has little doubt that PayPal does have cooperation and agreements with the NSA. And so there is, of course, the question about Omidyar spending $250 million to form a new journalistic endeavor with Greenwald at the helm, the man who is famous for reporting on the NSA, who has so far not reported anything about the NSA-PayPal relationship, assuming that there is any documentation on that. What do you say about that potential conflict of interest that's really at the heart of this particular venture?
Well, we have to understand that billionaires are financial institutions. These are not individuals. These are vast operations. They, too, cooperate with governments. Otherwise, they would not be billionaires. Governments don't allow billionaires much freedom. And so that, nor is there anything unusual about PayPal cooperating with governments. All financial institutions, foremost and first most, cooperate with governments. That's a legal requirement in all countries. So to single out PayPal for this is to miss that all financial institutions do this. And all accumulated wealth people cooperate with governments, not least of which because of the looming cloud of the IRS watching everything they do. And so if you work with billionaires, you'll find that their biggest apprehension is how to keep governments happy with them. But that's true of all wealthy people. And so I think that some of these issues are just coming to the attention of those who have not had much experience with great wealth. And by the way, one of the things about great wealth, it's hard to get the truth about it. So, you know, there's this famous thing about someone promising $200 million to an institution and it never appears. So these large numbers are not believable at the moment because great wealth never tells the truth about its wealth. IRS even has trouble finding out what they've got. So $250 million at the moment is a fiction. It's a PR stunt, as with Bezos and others. But if you watch what happens when these billionaires actually get involved at the Times or the Washington Journal, you see that the amount of money is much less. They don't take chances with their wealth.
So it sounds overall that you are, I suppose, ideologically against the way in which this is being reported by the Guardian and Greenwald at the moment in terms of this drip-drab of release. But it's not a question of suspicion of the motivations that's going on here, or how do you frame that that question of the way in which Greenwald and others have chosen to release this information?
Well, one is that it's almost certain that they've been restricted by the governments of the outlets that are located, and so that in order to avoid admitting what's going on, you cook up various other kinds of stories, and so Britain is much more stringent against the media than the U.S. is and some other countries. And so the two outlets, the Guardian has been hounded and controlled much more than Washington Post, but Washington Post is not a free agent either. And so that I think they're trying to make the best of a situation, which is to use the material that they can without having it stolen or, if you will, retaken from them, or otherwise stigmatized. So I think they're trying to milk it for what they can. And even Greenwald says, well, he hasn't always agreed with what the Guardian has done. He'd like to see more. Now, we don't know if that's crocodile tears or true, but that it's fairly common that if you start publishing top-secret material, or very much of it, that has not been handed to you by the spies, which is where it usually comes from, is that you're going to get in trouble. And so you work under those conditions. And make the best of it, because you know it's a very popular topic. The public eats this stuff up, and so it doesn't take much to get a bunch of readers to read this. And of course, what you do is you talk about anonymous sources and you show classification symbols on the documents. Washington Times used to publish a lot of this because they had good leads to the CIA. They published a lot of top secret stuff several years ago, and as have others. So this is a frenzy, in part manufactured for eyeball reason, gathering eyeballs, if you compare it to other instances of this taking place. But one of the things that we're sensitive to right now is the notion that if you dump this material, you're being irresponsible. We happen to strongly disagree with that. We think that's just a marketing scam to claim to be irresponsible to dump. And right now, WikiLeaks is taking the blame for that, whereas we've done more of that than WikiLeaks has, but of course not had the coverage that they've gotten. So we think dumps are healthy. It should not be filtered through journalists who have their own agenda. All of them have their own agenda, and it's venal. And so we need free access to this, and then let others decide what to make of the material, not just people who are vetted ahead of time by governments and boards of directors and lawyers.
Well, it's a very admirable philosophy, and one that, again, we've talked about in our previous conversation, and that I think is a very different model than the one we've been presented in recent years by, for example, WikiLeaks and with this latest release of documents. Of course, it does bring up the question of the financial motivations. Obviously, this is a type of industry in and of itself, the publication of classified material. Ooh, and it, as you say, it does come with it a certain built-in readership who are enticed by the prurient nature of the information and the way in which it was acquired and the cloak and dagger type feeling to this information. In that regard, then, how do we read, for example, the indication that that Glenn Greenwald himself has now recently signed a book deal, which will be coming out presumably in the new year, that will apparently contain information that has so far not been published in any of the journalistic endeavors that he's involved with? Does this indicate that he is perhaps sitting on some of the information in order to directly profit from it?
Yeah, absolutely. But he's not alone. Reporters at the Times, Walpole, have all published books with such classified information that they hold back. And so that nothing exceptional about Greenwald, except he's just, it's happening so fast with him. These other folks, James Ryson, Seymour Hersh, just go down the list, Bob Woodward, they've all published classified information in books, which are not published in newspapers. Books have somewhat greater latitude to publish this than newspapers do. And so books are usually where the best stuff comes out. That's why we like libraries over newspapers, because newspapers have to sell headlines, and books, you have a different PR mechanism for that. Movie tie-ins are quite common. There have been dozens of spy movies. It's a genre now that's been around since Kennedy touted James Bond. And so spy stories have been big sellers, and it waxes and wanes. But right now, we have a boom going on. A lot of ex-spies are helping out with this. It's a lucrative field. One or two of them have been burned by talking too much, but others write novels under pseudonyms and advise movies. And so it's something of a very sexualized thing to do.
And along with that comes, of course, the veneration of the people who are bringing this information, the reporters and others, so that, for example, their team seems to be the type of cult of personality built around people like Greenwald, that they are the crusading heroes who are shining the light on government corruption and the like. And they are the ones that are bringing this information to the public, which, of course, creates a type of industry of the self. It becomes a marketing of a type of personality. Can you speak to that particular aspect of this, and the veneration of some of these journalists who are given this information?
Well, it's a good one, because I think these are techniques are well established. Woodward and Bernstein, Hersh, just go down the list. People even going back into the 19th century who became famous for doing this kind of thing, whether it's corporate corruption or governmental corruption. And certainly since the 70s, it's become a boom industry thanks to Woodward and Bernstein. Some of these folks have become quite wealthy as personalities, and you can see some of them coming out of the woodwork. They're my age. I mean, I'm 78, so I've been watching all these folks come along and admire them and eat their fancy food. And so the thing is that, but it also raises the issue of, does that personality code distort the information that's actually being covered? And the answer is yes, it is, and that is because the people who exploit the cultivation of celebrity actually say, well, the public doesn't really care about the details. It's too boring. We've got to go with the high profile, the personality, all the personal faults. And so some of what's happening to Greenwald happens to all these folks. They get pilloried, they get attacked, and they rise to the occasion. And but even he complains that people are not paying attention to the documents. And we say, well, welcome to the club. Is that if you let the media onto you as a personality, they will ignore your documents and say, let's not go there. Let's just go with the easy stuff, the profile, the controversy, your sexual orientation, how much money you're making. Now, of course, this is also a technique spies use to diminish the effect of documents. And so this kind of smearing of people is, by turning them into easily attackable celebrities, changes the story from the documents to the person. Greenwald's complained about that, but it's easy fare, and so it's easy to jump on him or praise him and not take the time to go to the library and read the documents. So we sit there and watch this and say, great, enjoy yourself. We're still waiting for the documents. because there are a few scholars and people like us who actually do love to do research and read this stuff and understand it and not get sucked into, you know, page six and high-profile people. But media, and by media, I don't mean just journalists. I mean the full spectrum really goes for the high-profile drama. And that's what brings in the money. And so let him make his money. It's fine. The thing is that he knows the consequence of that is there'll be less attention paid to the documents he's releasing, as WikiLeaks has found as well. If they don't do this hyperventilation, they don't get coverage in the press. No one reads the stuff that WikiLeaks puts up. No one reads the stuff we put up, at least not in the world of media. In fact, they always ask us for, give it to me in a nutshell, Mr. Young. I don't have time to read that. And we say, well, that's the difference. We don't like to give you nutshells. One, we don't know how, because nutshells always distort, and they're always filled with lies and exaggerations, and usually to the benefit of the person who's delivering the nutshell. And so it's been tempting to play that game, but we think it's actually destructive of the public trust to join the group of celebrities, because I think most people are turned off by celebrities.
I think so, and I think you're right. I mean, the creation of the kind of carnival atmosphere that comes around the hyperventilation that goes around these stories really does distort the information in one way or another, and perhaps people just would ignore it completely if there wasn't that hyperventilation, but again, that speaks more to the people themselves than the process, and again, that speaks, I think, to the philosophy of Cryptome and what you're doing there and the power, the true potential power for an idea like Cryptome of just dumping the information and letting the chips fall where they may. I mean, it certainly is a different approach and one that, again, is not receiving a lot of attention because, again, there is not that industry around, structured around such a distribution paradigm. I'm assuming that you're familiar with the articles that Sibel Edmonds has been publishing in recent days talking about this Omidyar, PayPal, Greenwald, NSA connection. What's your take on the stories? Do you think this is part of that smearing the man and not the documents, or is there some legitimate point to these articles?
Well, these kind of things are actually apropos. I think celebrities have to take harsh criticism. It can't be all adoration or loathing. But I think that Sibel has published a good critical article. We put up another one that it needs more research and more coverage in order that the story not go completely off the chart into win or lose. I think there's a lot of nuance involved here, and I think the nuance is helpful because it's hard to come by. And so I think that Sibel did a great piece, and I think we'll see more of that. At one point, Greenwald did great pieces of criticizing celebrity politicians and others. And so I think he's quite familiar with what this is about. Unfortunately, he's gotten in a bad habit of lashing back at this almost in a petulant kind of way. But then celebrities do that. And either that or their agents tell them to do that because it pleases their fans. And Twitter, of course, is perfect for that lashback. But eventually I think he will overcome that and stop demeaning himself by being petulant. But it takes a while to develop the scar tissue required to not be bothered by these seeming first glance as though they're personal attacks. But actually, Sibel's stuff went well below the surface, and it's long overdue, and I hope others will emulate that. Of course, she's been heavily attacked for writing this article. Again, those who are pushing for a black and white approach to this, you know, are actually quite destructive. And so that also is a warning shot to others who might dare challenge this kind of celebrity thing, is that the fans go berserk.
Unfortunately, and so people, yeah.
And it can have consequences. I mean, it can affect people's perception of you, that we don't want to associate with someone who's so controversial. But every strong person who has gone public with their views face this. And Sibel's been through it. She's been at this for a long time. You've been at it. There are any number of people who've been at it. And the question always comes up, well, how far can I go before I appear to be a nut? I say, keep on going. Nowhere near, because it's such a hegemon of suppression of strong views that are not venal and commercial. And what passes for strong views in the world of commercial journalism is so tepid, it's actually moved the bar out of reach. So we'd like to see more sites doing this and see what comes of it. By the way, this demonization of the person's lifestyle is not trivial. Assange has suffered from it. Greenwald is likely to suffer from it. And so one of the techniques of the opposition of outspoken people is to destroy them personally, entrap them, do all sorts of nasty things. And so this is a long tradition. And some people just don't want to go there. Greenwald, I think, has shown considerable courage over the years, and I'm surprised that he fell for the Almodóvar ploy.
Hmm.
But he's got to make a living.
Well,
and as he said, it was irresistible. But I think that had he dealt with billionaires before, that's how they woo you. They're always irresistible.
Well, with enough zeros...
Until you find out what it's like to work with them.
Well, exactly. Perhaps that will come later. But with enough zeros, I'm sure anyone can be enticed. It is an interesting situation. And as you say, we will have to see how this develops and be more open-minded about this. Because obviously there is the twin, pincher movement of veneration versus demonization, whereas reality usually lies somewhere in the middle. So let's move on. I mean, I think that this is a topic we'll have to return to in the future as things continue to develop. But I guess the ultimate base underlying all of this is the question of Snowden himself and these documents and whether this is all a legitimate quote-unquote leak and, you know, where this is coming from. And I think I would be remiss in my journalistic duties if I didn't ask you your opinion on this and what your take on Snowden is. Ultimately, is he a genuine whistleblower? Is this itself some sort of trap that's being laid by the NSA or the CIA or whoever might be behind this type of operation?
Well, based on what little we actually have heard from him directly, he was far too trusting of his outlets. I think he was just inexperienced and based his judgment upon what he had read in the press. And so unless he's playing the fool on purpose, I think he's been very susceptible to giving this stuff over to commercial outlets without. Now, he may have a safety package that he can release if he really doesn't like it, and I would imagine that he does. If he doesn't like the way it goes, he will do something else. But I think whether this is a testing of Greenwald and others, or if this is the only ploy he's got, remains an open question. And so that I think that it's going to be an interesting thing over the next year or two as to whether or not we're going to actually see more documents, if NSA is going to ransom them, as they've suggested they're willing to do, or Almodóvar gets outfoxed. I'll just throw a little tip toward you. The role of billionaires has gotten quite intense here lately. The Koch's, Soros, all these folks, Bloomberg, all these folks have risen to the top. So there's kind of a war going on among billionaires now. And they're actually becoming much more public in their activities, and we'll see what comes of all that. And so these private, almost mercenary, if you will, initiatives is interesting to those of us who watch billionaires at work over the years, usually quite discreetly. So they're now going public. And I think that is probably as more interesting than what Snowden has done.
Interesting. Well, there is a very interesting subtext that's working its way through this. But at the end of the day, given the information we have, your sense is that Snowden was genuine and was somehow able to acquire these tens of thousands or millions of documents from the NSA?
He got what he got. And that I think that where it is right now, I think is... It's very interesting. I think the black market is desperate to get their hands on this and would do almost anything to get it. And so how secure it is not comforting, that based on most reporters' inexperience with communication security and information security, I suspect it's not well protected. And so this stuff is often stolen from beneath people's eyes and a dud left in its place and they don't even know it. And so right now it's not clear who's got their hands on this stuff. But it's valuable, and course, we don't have any duds Snowden put out, too. We don't have any of the documents are fake, either faked by NSA to track, like Iridium is tracked. We just don't have enough data to know who got tricked here. But certainly NSA is capable of tricking people like Snowden by giving access to information that is not all that secret.
Exactly. Well, this, I mean, there's just so many layers of smoke and mirrors going on here, and I'm sure you're used to dealing with this in the work that you do all the time at Cryptome, but it's a bit overwhelming for the average person to wrap their mind all the various permutations of possibilities. So, unfortunately,
I'll just mention, it's a good learning time about these new techniques, because the James Bond stuff has misled people for decades. This is really intricate stuff.
It certainly is. And again, you've actually introduced an aspect of this that I wasn't even thinking about, which, of course, is the black market interest in this. And of course, there'd be all sorts of non-state actors that equally would be interested in this information and presumably targeting people like Greenwald who have this information in their possession. So again, extremely, extremely interesting. And I think we're going to have to leave it there for now. But once again, let's just direct people to cryptome.org, which is a vast treasure trove, an online library of information, and again, it's just put there without hyperbole for you to do with as you see fit, and to incorporate it in your own way. So a very different philosophy than what we've seen in recent years from some of these other high profile leak sites. John Young, always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're most welcome.